Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
So we are here at the 2025 NATA convention in Orlando. We have Mitch Hauschildt. He is the Prevention, Rehab, and Physical Performance Coordinator at Missouri State University, the Missouri State Bears in Springfield, Missouri. Mitch, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good meeting you guys.
You are a master dry needler and a master dry needling instructor.
Yes.
I recently did my first few sessions of dry needling for my neck and trapezial pain during some training for some endurance events, so I am ecstatic to talk to you about that. Tell us a little bit about your experience with dry needling.
So I love dry needling, for one. And this wasn't intentional, but it just kind of the way it's worked out. I actually, to my knowledge, I'm the only athletic trainer in the country that's teaching, certifying other people in dry needling. So I think as athletic trainers that we're trying to advance our profession, right, I like to think that I've had some opportunities to help all of us, right? And so that's part of that. But for me, I started seeing that coming around, I don't know, probably 15 years ago, right? We started hearing people doing dry needling, and I was super intrigued and super interested. And at that time, no organizations were allowing athletic trainers to take their courses. And so I was frustrated, but through my various networks, people I got to know, I've known over the years, I actually had an organization said, hey, given your background, your history, what you do as a rehab coordinator, yeah, we'll let you come into one of our courses. So I was ready to jump in, and then I went to the university and said, hey, this is what I want to do. Went to our physicians. Well, legal counsels get involved, and they are all risk averse and said, you know what, that you would be like maybe one of five athletic trainers in the country doing this. We're not ready to be that far out front. So I had to kind of bide my time a little bit until it became a little bit more of an accepted practice for athletic trainers, and started using it on my patients and had great success, and then kept in touch with some of my instructors who I, you know, taught for various companies over the years, and they were looking for another instructor. So I came on, and so now I get to teach it, which is a blast.
Today's episode is sponsored by Get Raw, a potent antioxidant blend made with all raw organic ingredients. The Get Raw ginger turmeric formulation is 200 to 300 times more bioavailable to the human body. Documented benefits include decreased inflammation, improved digestion, immunity, cognition, and more. Get healthy, get well, get raw, the organic wellness shot.
What are the pathologies that you're most using it for, and where have you seen the best results?
Well, for one, just pain in general is your number one, right? According to the research, pain is best, most well-researched item that we can treat with dry needling. From there, it's like tight, taut tissue. For me, I always say like a tight hamstring, and my athletes come in and say, it feels like it's going to strain. It feels like it's going to pull. Hey, you know what? Let's drop needles in that. And it's a game changer for them. Other than that, you know, generalized pain, a lot of tendonitis, tendinosis type stuff. And then if we just got some dysfunction, right? Like maybe you've got shoulder pain, you know, I'm going to go after infraspinatus, teres minor, rhomboids, that area, because it's typically pretty dysfunctional, right? And or maybe I'm going after pec major to open that front up. So I'm really looking at my overall evaluation and trying to figure out, can I downregulate tone here? Can I bring more awareness there? And maybe using needles as a way to do that.
And are you hooking up, are you clipping the TENS machine's needles, the TENS machine to the needles? Are you doing dynamic or static cupping along with the dry needling?
Yeah, so great questions. STEM is fantastic. Now I will say, again, if we're looking at just dry needling for pain, according to the literature, we should probably always be using STEM. And the research shows that you've got a significant increase in the release of endogenous opiates with STEM on our needles. It's not something I typically do right out of the gate. I'll try some needles first, see how my patient tolerates it, see how they like it. And then we can always go to that as sort of an advancement. But it is great for pain, according to the literature. I'm going to use a lot of other tools as well. You know, now you have to start to get it. There's some nuances you have to be a little bit careful. Like you brought up cupping, right? Like I'm probably going to be cupping at some point while I'm doing dry needling. Now, is it the same time? No. And if I am going to do it in the same treatment, I have to make sure I cut before I needle. Otherwise, you get wet cupping, right? We're going to pull some blood out of the skin, and that's not something I'm really interested in doing. So there's kind of some nuances there of like timing and sequencing, how you do some of that. But I'm also lucky working at a university. Where I'm a little bit different than the clinical setting where, you know, if I want to treat my athletes 3 hours a day, 6 days a week, I get to do that, right? Because we pay our athletes. And regardless of what anybody said, we've always done it to a certain degree. And so it's easier for me to say, hey, you know what? Today, all we're going to do is dry needling. And then tomorrow, I'm going to do all those other things, right? Where in a clinical setting, most people are trying to pack all this stuff into 1 hour, hour and 15 minute treatment. So I've got some luxuries there that I can do some different things where I'm not always trying to do everything at the same time. I may do, you know, one thing one day, another modality another day, those kinds of things.
Can you give an example of if someone comes in and they say, I want dry needling, like an athlete?
Yeah.
When do you make that distinction? We talk about pain, loss of motion. How do you come up to that athlete and have a conversation with them? What is the reason why you're doing it versus not
sure.
doing it?
No, so great questions. As much as I love dry needling, it's not my first go-to right out of the gate. There are risk factors. And a lot of people don't like needling. However, in this today's world, it's changed, right? It used to be, I've been at the university 18 years now. It used to be when you're a Division I athletic trainer, when our athletes came in, it was good enough to be a Division I athletic trainer. Everybody just trusted what we said. Well, now everybody's got access to so much information, right? Mm-hmm. And they've all got their own pitching coaches or their own strength coaches or their own PTs that they worked with. So a lot of people will come in and say, I had needling when I was in high school and I loved it. Okay, well, that gives me good information to know. Now, I also have some that say, I had it and I hated it. I will never do it again. Well, we might do things a little bit differently. Let's give it a shot. But typically I will, depending on a lot of factors, but somebody comes in, they're having some pain, they're having an injury. You know, I'm gonna work with them with some of our other modalities first. I might do a little instrument-assisted work or some cupping or all my other manual mobilizations, things like that. And if I'm not seeing the improvement I want to see, then dry needling is always on the table. But if they come in and say, hey, I want that, I'm probably going to go to it a little bit faster just because I love it and I think it is a game changer of a tool. And if they've already had great success with it, they've bought in, which I'm a big believer, guys, that getting our patients to buy into what we're doing is half the battle, right? And if our patients believe in whatever it is, doesn't matter what tool we're using, but they believe in it, our odds of having success are exponentially higher than me trying to shove something down their throat and say, no, you need a needle. Like, if they don't want a needle, it's probably not going to work for them. Or if they say, hey, needling is the only thing that works for me, I may disagree with that, but if they're bought in, I'm going to jump to it a little bit faster than I normally would.
Now, we talked a little bit before about this, some barriers that athletic trainers need to overcome, or even physical therapists with some of the organizations in the districts or states they're working in.
Sure.
With the acupuncturist groups and of that nature, and even physician groups. What's the education piece that you provide to say that we are qualified to be able to take this 27-hour didactic course on dry needling?
Yeah.
And we actually can apply it in a way that's going to be beneficial for our athletes and patients.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's ever changing. You know, there was a lot of turf battles over the years. And then I felt like things kind of settled down. And then now it seems like we're hearing more kind of turf battles again of acupuncturists or PT boards or chiro boards. And really, I get frustrated by it because what it comes down to is people are afraid that they're going to lose their patients, right? This is all about money, right? They're afraid, well, if athletic trainers can do it, then they might take some of my patients. My argument against that is, guys, I think we can all agree that there's more than enough sick, unhealthy people in our country that if we're good at what we do, we're going to have enough work for the rest of our life.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, right? Now, if we're not very good at what we do, like, that's a battle, right? Good luck. But that has nothing to do with dry needling or anything else. So I just think if you're threatened by my ability to do something, like, that's more on you than it is on me. With that being said, there's legal issues, right? Like every state has different laws. I mean, states like New York and Washington, like nobody's out there needling. But other states like Missouri, where I'm at, shoot, it's like pretty wide open.
Yeah.
Now, I will say it's interesting to me because most states, athletic trainers work under physician protocol. And in most states, we actually have a stronger legal stance if we get called into court than PTs or chiros do. I know at least in Missouri, because in Missouri, where I'm at, the PT board has not made an official stance over all these years. They haven't said they can't do it, but they haven't said they can. So for them, There's, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of PTs in Missouri that are dry needling in a gray zone. I work under physician protocol. As long as he's comfortable with me doing it, he signs off on it, I'm good to go. Now, I've got his backing if I get called into court to say that I can do that. But, you know, with regards to the education piece, I mean, you know, I teach a, you know, we have a 27-hour course. It's intense. It's long. You come in, you're gonna put in a lot of needles in people. You're going to get a lot of needles put into you. It's not that fun of a weekend for most people, but they love having those skill set when they come out. We were talking earlier, I kind of, one of the arguments I always say to people is, when they argue that acupuncturist or somebody else has 300 or 400 or 500 hours, whatever, before they can start practicing, why should we be able to go to a weekend course? Well, my argument to that is always like, hey, I have an undergrad and a master's degree that teach me all about the human body. Now all I need to know is how to put needles in the skin.
Where it's coursework.
Correct. Where their 400 hours teaches all of that in that one education. Right. I'm not hating on their education. I'm just saying it's just different. And so we still have a really strong understanding of the human body. Now it is just that advanced coursework that you're trying to learn this one tool, this one modality.
Yeah, we had a great conversation yesterday with a good friend and peer of mine, colleague, and we talked about physician oversight. And in the state of Massachusetts, athletic trainers are under the umbrella of a physician with direct order or protocol.
Same
in Missouri. And it's the same thing. Yeah. Whatever modality you feel like you need for your athlete, if it's under the direct supervision, then you're, again, you have a better backing and oversight, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and working in the college setting, I'm lucky. Like, I have fantastic relationships with our physicians. They've become great friends of mine. One of our orthopedic surgeons was actually a high school athlete of mine years ago. And then he went to med school and became a, you know, sports medicine fellowship trained surgeon. And we laugh because he likes to be Richard Seagrave III. I'm like, dude, you're Ricky, right? Yeah. Like, you're the high school punk that I trained years ago.
That's this guy.
I was not a high school punk, but I was one of Riz's athletes.
Right. So, but it's funny. We still have that relationship, but there's mutual respect. But I mean, my docs, I can call or text anytime, and they trust me to do what we need to do. And I think that's the key, right? Is any of these kinds of advanced tools or modalities where we just have to have fantastic relationships with our physicians and open lines of communication. That just helps everybody.
How do we in the orthopedic surgery community raise awareness or allow our patients to have access to dry needling? And how do we spread that information to other orthopedic surgeons?
It's a great question because that's kind of on the other side. I mean, I think it comes down to just being aware that it exists, right? And how it works. And I think in the orthopedic surgery world, it's like we all sort of get stuck in our own tunnel, right? And I think knowing how, why, when is a big thing. And then it's just a matter of knowing who you trust to be able to do that and refer those patients out. But again, I think it just comes down to that constant communication piece. And my surgeons, as much as I love them, they just be like, hey, listen, we've had this conversation. I don't know what you do. I don't pretend to know what you do. I just know my patients get better when they see you. So go do what you do. And like, that's best case scenario.
And that's a great compliment.
It's the voodoo that you do.
Right. That you and I would say like, listen, I don't really understand what you do in the OR, right? Yeah. Like, I've been there. I've watched it. But I'm not going to pretend to understand why you're really good and somebody else isn't. Yeah. But what I know is when I see your patients, they always look fantastic. So let's keep working together.
Yeah.
And those are the kinds of conversations that I think the more people, I think, unfortunately, in the athletic training world, a lot of people are afraid to sort of approach physicians and surgeons. They feel intimidated by them.
Yeah.
And the more we can sort of bring down egos and all just get on the same page, I think that's a huge step forward.
And that's a commonality you've heard all weekend, right? Or all week for the last couple of days is that same thing. It's about communication. It's about checking your ego at the door. It's about working together. It's about having a communication path and everything else because you're doing the same thing. You're trying to get that patient better on all angles in all areas.
Listen, I always say that in my younger years, when I was a little more arrogant than I am now, I used to think I can rehab any surgeon's ACL, right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. They all do the same thing. Yeah. It's all on me, right? And then I started seeing a few from some surgeons. I was like, I don't know why this kid's not getting better, but there's a commonality here.
Yeah, right.
And
I've seen may be a little too far anterior.
The tunnel's just not quite where we need it. And, you know, my younger years, I didn't understand all that. And then you get some experience and it's like, wow, all right, there is a difference. And on the flip side, surgeons, you typically say the same, right? Like, I don't know. So the best guys to work with are the ones that realize they do their part, we do our part. And as long as everybody's on the same page, we get good outcomes. But it has to work both ways. I have to have somebody in the OR that does a great job And then I have to do my part on the back end. Otherwise, something's going
to
get missed.
And you have to constantly communicate. Like you said, you have these great relationships with these docs. In my clinic, we have therapy in every clinic. So I'm able to literally walk across the hall and speak to my therapist or text them. If I'm in the OR and one of the therapists is seeing one of my patients, he or she will text me and say, what do you think of this wound? Yeah. Does this look okay? Yeah. Can I take the sutures out? Can we start active range of motion blocking exercises, et cetera? And that I think is integral, especially for someone early in his career, to best patient outcomes. And I know that's super helpful for your profession.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I love the fact, like my surgeons, the minute they step out of the OR with one of our athletes, they're either texting me or calling me. Hey, here's what I saw. Here's what I did. Here's what I want you to be careful of. That's huge for me, right? And then to your point, I take the dressings off. It's like, ooh,
yeah,
looks a little funky.
Send a quick picture, right?
Hey, just so you're aware, and we're all on the same page, I want you to know this is what I see. And that's a huge communication.
And if you slip behind the curtain, if the patient is amazed that you are in direct contact with their surgeon and vice versa. So the patient's worried about their wound. They're not seeing their surgeon maybe for 10 to 14 days.
Right.
Well, you say, oh, I'll just text your surgeon right now. We'll have an answer in 5 minutes.
Correct.
That's huge for patient anxiety levels, patient satisfaction, yeah, recovery.
The buy-in.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, it's just like we were just talking about, right? Like, if my patient buys into what we're doing, my odds of having good success are much higher. And so that just is another component of that patient buy-in for both of us, right? It works back and forth.
Yeah.
And like you talk about patient satisfaction, like that's everything to health systems, right? Is like, are they filling out the survey correctly, right? And giving you all the good feedback. It's just part of it.
But happy patients lead to good results. Right. And if they trust their athletic trainers, if they trust their physical and occupational therapists, and if they trust their surgeons, then they're going to have a higher propensity for good results. And that's all we care about.
Yeah, no question.
Now, how do we connect the dots from injury management to performance? And how do you do that in your role? Is there a certain criteria that you guys follow? Is it the same for everybody? Like, how does that work in your
system? Yeah, so really good question. And it's ever changing and evolving. And again, it comes down a lot to relationships and personalities.
Yeah.
Main reason I got hired 18 years ago at Missouri State was there was a complete disconnect between our strength coaches and our athletic trainers.
Yeah.
They didn't talk to each other. They didn't want to talk to each other. They didn't want to work together. The athletic trainers didn't trust the strength coaches. So they would just literally, somebody had a little bit of an ache or pain and just shut them down, you're not lifting today. And then the strength coaches would get mad and whatever. And so I've always described myself as a strength coach who happens to be an athletic trainer. I'm a strength coach first. And when you see my rehab, it is very movement-based. I love getting guys under loads and things like that. And so I do have the ability to kind of speak both languages, right? And talk about periodization and load management, those kinds of things, but also go over here and do some manual therapies. And so when I first got hired, it was really just for me to be a mediator between the two, right? And just make sure that everybody is talking. And then over the years, we've really evolved and we've been able to hire some really good strength coaches. Right now, I mean, we have a fantastic set of strength coaches at our university that get it. And when I say get it, like they understand their role, number one, is to keep our guys on the field. And so they aren't so worried all the time about specific numbers. Like those are important for our coaches, right? But they're very much interested in working with us. And so we meet on a regular basis. Our football strength coach, he and I sit down every single day and go through our injury report with football. Him, myself, and our athletic trainer for football. And every single day we go over every single person one-on-one or every individual person that's on our injury report. And he knows what he's supposed to do. I know what I'm supposed to do. Our athletic trainer knows what they're supposed to do. And that makes for this really seamless handoff of, you know, athletes that are working with me now have, you know, I can trust what's happening in the weight room. They're not going to get hurt or they're not going to do something they shouldn't be doing. But I also make him comfortable because he's still able to make his coaches happy because they're evolving. And I think one of the mindset kind of shifts that I made with our staff years ago was we're in the performance business. Now, as athletic trainers, we're typically think of, well, I'm the medical staff, right? And we're managing injuries and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we're in the performance business because every day that our athletes aren't competing, aren't working out, aren't practicing, their performance is being hindered, right? So our job is to get them doing something as fast as humanly possible. So I've got our guys in the weight room a couple of days after surgery doing something, right? because that's where they want to be. That's where they need to be. And so I think that communication piece is huge, and finding the strength staff and the individuals that understand that we're all in this together and they have a role in injury management, just like I do. I think that's the huge piece.
Now, just talking briefly about prevention, how does it fit into your, I guess, beginning of season testing for athletes? You do FMS or functional movement screens with athletes, and do you have the capacity to do it?
So
done in the past, you feel it's important, excited. I think there's a mixed bag with people on what that is and how it works.
And you guys are asking a lot of good questions, which I love. This is fun for me. I try not to get on a big soapbox and just go.
No, this soapbox is yours. This soapbox is yours, Mitch.
Well, prevention.
I appreciate that. So the injury prevention piece. So again, going back to when I was hired, like I was intentional about that was the number one part of my title, right? Like I'm here to prevent injuries. That's what I wanted my role to be. And for years and years and years, it was, that was it. And that's, and the rehab piece was just a part of what I did. And we had a very robust testing system where we did functional movement screen. We do a lumbopelvic screen, foot biomechanical screen, and then hop and stop tests, looking at single leg power, single leg deceleration. I mean, it was great, right? And so then we would take all that data and we would do that usually twice a year. So typically we would do that right after the season was over. Well, ideally we'd do it when our new kids came in, freshmen come in. And then as soon as the season was over, so take football example, for example, November, we would run everybody. We'd take a solid week and we would run everybody through that screen. And then we would spend our off-season training that. Now we toyed with a lot of different things, whether we did it in the weight room, which is my preferred way to do it, or if we didn't have the capacity to do it up there, our athletes would come in that needed some sort of cleanup work and do some corrective stuff in the training room or one-on-one or in small groups. And then, you know, they go to spring practice, then we screen them again after spring practice to get them ready for summer training. And I was like, it was huge. And my administrators loved it because we were able to show in those first few years that we were saving the university somewhere in the range of $300,000 to $350,000 a year.
Huge.
Yeah, right. And especially at that time, right? That it's different, you know, things cost more now, but it was a huge savings for our athletics department. Well, as time has evolved, we still do some versions of that. But we've also integrated a lot more technology. So force plate technology, when it became a deal 5-6 years ago, we invested. And now we can monitor athletes every week, if not multiple times a week, with a simple vertical jump and get a lot of really valuable information. And so that has taken the place of a lot of the older screens that we were doing, just because it's easier for us to manage more than anything. But with all that being said, I gotta be honest, we're doing what I consider less injury prevention than we ever have and that I'm comfortable with. And most of that is due to the changing nature of NCAA sports.
Yeah.
With the transfer portal, with athletes coming in and out.
The time investment.
We can't invest, guys. Yeah. We can't invest in guys for 4 or 5 years. You know, it used to be guys came in as freshmen and we'd like, hey, this guy's going to be a project.
Yeah.
And we're going to redshirt them and we're going to invest in them. But we know when they're juniors, they're going to be a really, really good athlete.
Yeah.
Now, like, shoot. We don't register anybody if they can give me 5 reps this year, I'm going to take it because I don't know what they're going to do next year. And so, unfortunately, I think another big soapbox I'm going to try to avoid, but it's actually hurting our athletes. We're not developing athletes anymore right now in the NCAA. All it is is don't break your kids because you're only going to have them for a few months. Then they're going to go to a season and then we don't know what's next.
Yeah.
And so it's all about these quick turnarounds and can we keep our guys on the field for the next season? Can we get them to perform the next season? But that's hurting the long-term athletic development of our kids. Yeah. And I would say this number is probably high, but it feels like it's at least 75% of the guys that come out of transfer portal are broken. Yeah. But I spend so much time just trying to fix guys that come out of the portal. And I think that's for a lot of reasons, right? Like kids get injured and they just like, I'm going to go somewhere else. Some schools, when you say I'm going to the portal, it's like, you're dead to us. Like, we don't provide you.
It's unfortunate. Anymore.
It is, right? So, I mean, we had a kid that just transferred in, and I won't say the school it came from, but he had hip surgery, had a hip scope. He went to therapy at the school for a couple of weeks and then said, I'm going to go in the portal. So he comes to us, and for the last 6 weeks, he's like, I'm doing my own therapy.
Yeah.
Really? Like, you're doing your own
therapy? I can see the wheels turning your brain right now.
You just came from an SEC school.
Yeah, and this is great.
And you're coming to me. And you expect to be ready to play when we go to USC on August 30th and you're 8 weeks removed from a hip scope and you haven't had anything?
Yeah.
Like, so then it's like, now I'm trying to chase my tail. So it's really changed a lot. I'd love to say that I was doing all these fun injury prevention things, but we don't have the capacity right now with the changing nature of the sport.
Which is unfortunate for what
it is. It's horrible for our kids.
Yeah.
Stay on the soapbox, Mitch. So we had Dr. James Andrews on one of our previous episodes, and we talked a lot about the transfer portal and the NIL. And what's interesting is he and Nick Saban actually retired the same month.
Yeah.
And I'm not attributing their retirement to the introduction or the burgeoning of the transfer portal or NIL, but
Saban's been pretty vocal, right? Let's be honest.
Yeah. It is out there. Uh-huh. But anyway, we had a great episode with Dr. James Andrews. You're sort of stuck now in this transfer portal NIL area. So how do you, as an athletic trainer, adapt to that? And what can you offer to our athletes, even in the short term, to give them the best possible outcome?
So one of the biggest things we've done in this portal era is we have finally convinced our coaches that we need to be part of their recruiting process. And we've said it for years, like, let us do just even a quick injury screen, something during the recruiting process so you know what you're getting. And forever, they just said, we don't have time or it doesn't matter. Well, then a few years ago when the NCAA created the 4-4 transfer rule, which people aren't familiar with that, basically what it means is if you're coming from one four-year institution to another four-year institution and our coaches offer you a scholarship and you sign on the dotted line, when you step on campus, whether you play at all, you could be there one day, decide, I'm not going to go anymore. I don't feel like playing anymore. We have to honor your scholarship until you graduate. So when that rule came into effect a couple of years ago, suddenly our coach is like, wait a second. If I bring a kid in who is a disaster medically and I ignore all that stuff and they get here and they can't ever play for me, not only am I losing that money, but I'm losing that scholarship counts, so I can't go out and get somebody else, and I'm stuck with them for the next possibly 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's a big wake-up call for our coaches, right? No question. So now, when our kids, almost all of our sports, when our kids come in on an official visit, we already have all their medical background. We have HIPAA signed, so we can actually speak with their previous school and know what they're like as individuals, what their work ethic is like, what injuries they've had. And then we do a physical evaluation, which is allowed in the NCAA as part of that official visit. And then we go to our coaches and say, here's what I see. Here's your risk factors. Now, you can go do it if you want to. You can offer that kid, but you're not going to come back at us and say, we didn't know, or why aren't they playing? Because we're giving you that knowledge.
Because now they're like a pro athlete. Pro athletes, they do it all the time. You come into the Patriot, you're getting MRI, you're doing all that stuff.
Right?
You should do that in the NCAA.
And that's where we're going, right? That's where it's evolving to. And so that's been the biggest thing for us. You know, as far as like, how do the athletes navigate that? I don't know. Like, honestly, the athletes, and I've got teenagers now who my kids are, they've got good friends that are getting recruited at a high level and their parents are coming to me like, what do I need to know? And like, recruiting's it's crazy world, right? And I played college football in the 90s and it was a blast getting recruited, right? Like everybody tells you the greatest thing since sliced bread. And it was so much fun. You get to travel and see all these schools. And now it's like, well, you do all those things, but now you got like, you also have NIL agents. And I'm going to use that in air quotes because nobody knows who these people are or where, what their backgrounds are. But they're coming in and saying, I can get you this money if you'll go over here and I'm going to take 15 or 20%. And these kids are like, okay, like, I guess, right? And the other problem is a lot of schools overcommit because they don't know what their rosters are going to look like, right? And so they're overcommitting to these kids. And then at the last minute, they're seniors in high school and they're getting these offers retracted. And then they're out of the recruiting game. They don't know what to do. So it puts these kids at a really difficult spot. You know, as far as their physical health, I mean, I think it just comes down to finding places where they feel comfortable. They trust their coaching staff. They like the athletic training staff, the strength staff. And, you know, trust becomes a big thing. And knowing they're not going to get left out to dry.
So where you've experienced NIL, I mean, what are your true thoughts on it, right? I think we know the answer to that, I think. But is it bad for NCAA? Does it need reform at this point?
I'm old school, right? Like, I remember when I played and I was happy to have an education, right? It's not like that anymore. I think NIL is ruining college sports. I really do. I think it's ruining it. I think it's turned it into, as Nick Saban says, right? It's about, like, how much do I get, right?
Yeah.
Instead of being here to get the education and advance and grow as young men and women to be productive members of our society. So I think it is larger hurting the game. Now, it is changing the House settlement that came out. We finally got information from them a few weeks ago. Now there's going to be this revenue sharing, this cap of $20.5 million per school, that's a huge step forward because I do think it's going to pull things in a little bit. But if I'm being honest, a school like us, like, we don't have $20 million to pay our athletes.
Right.
Like, I mean, our whole football collective for the last few years is $300,000 for our whole football team, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not getting us where we need to go to compete with P4 schools. So it's still the has versus the have nots, but I think we're always going to have that to a certain degree. So, but I, as a purist, I don't like it.
Yeah. Rock tape. I know. I'm like, that was so great.
I know.
I'm like, oh, now we have to talk about kinesio tape, which I want to talk about, but that's so awesome. Okay. Oh, that was so fired up. Okay. That was,
yeah. You explain to the people that don't know what Rock Tape is.
Sure.
Kinesio tape.
Was Rock Tape a brand name?
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you explain a little bit about it? Why it's important to use as a modality or a modality of choice for you?
Yeah. So I've been a Rock Tape instructor for 10, 11 years now, and that whole thing has changed a lot. There was in like 2018, 2019, we were teaching amongst all of our instructors about 1,000 courses a year. It was wild how it just exploded, right? And we took off, and then COVID hit and it changed really the continuing education game. So we're not teaching anywhere close to that anymore, but I still use tape a lot. So Rock Tape, yes, it's a brand of kinesiology tape, right? Kinesio is a brand, KT is a brand, Spider Tech, there's all these different brands of kinesiology tape. Interesting, almost all of them are made in the same three factories in China. They're all kind of reproducing their own product, right? Part of the reason I'm biased towards Rock Tape is we have our own factory in Korea and no one else produces their tape there. And we can control a lot of our quality controls. But, you know, kinesiology tape, when it first came out, I think I was skeptical just like everybody else was. And this goes back to like the 2008 Olympics, right? Like Kerry Walsh comes out, has all this tape over his shoulder and nobody knows why or how, but she won the gold medal going away. And then 2012 Olympics, like everybody had tape on her. And so we saw this huge growth. CrossFit was really expanding at that time. And Rock Tape's the official tape provider of CrossFit Games since the beginning. And so, but the question is like, how does it work? Why does it work? What we have to remember is our skin and our brain are derived from the same tissue in utero. So they are connected. Even later in life, our skin can be thought of as an extension of the brain. And so if I want to interact with the brain and the nervous system to give it different input, different information, I can do that easily through the skin. So whether I do that with a manual technique, and that's why I've always been a big believer of manual techniques. And I think anytime we can put our hands on our patients, it accelerates motor learning. It accelerates a lot of different things within the nervous system. But tape is just a way that I can constantly talk to the brain and give it more information. And so I can do that 24/7. Over and over and over again. So I love it for a lot of reasons. We can downregulate pain, sort of like pain gating, right? So think of a TENS unit. But what I really like it for is things like postural corrections and just constant feedback. Because, you know, when I teach, I say to a lot of the therapists that I work with, you know, you treat your patients like twice a week, right? And you have them 30, maybe 60 minutes, if you're lucky, depending on how your clinic is set up. Like, what are your patients doing the other 23 hours out of the day? And the answer is undoing everything you did in that 1 hour, right? Because they're overweight, they're sedentary, right. or smoking, or drinking, right? Like,
so poor tissue quality.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Right. So the advantage of something like a kinesiology tape is I can tape them as they go out the door, and I'm dripping slowly back to the brain, the nervous system, reminding them of all the things that we did subconsciously in that 1 hour. And it just allows those things to stick a little bit better, adds a little gasoline to what I'm doing clinically.
Yeah. Is there a piece to that where you would teach the patient how to apply it in certain instances?
Sure.
If they were going on vacation, you're like, hey, this actually worked for me. Yeah, let me show you how to use it.
Absolutely.
Does that transform your practice as an athletic trainer?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I always tell people, I don't want you married to tape. I don't want you to feel like as much as a tape manufacturer would love for me to sit here and say, you should tape your patients every single day for
more tape
miles. Right. It doesn't work that way, right? And I mean, I don't believe that, and I'm not going to teach something like that. But if we've established that tape is helpful and successful for people, then I have no problem saying, here's a roll of tape. Here's how you apply it to yourself. It's not rocket science, guys. It's changed a lot over the years. When I first started teaching Rock Tape, there was what I consider sort of an old school thought of, well, we have to have the right amount of stretch, and it has to go one direction. If I tape origin insertion, I'm going to have a different outcome than insertion to origin. And I tell you guys, there's absolutely zero research that proves any of that. They've all been
all anecdotal.
It's all anecdotal. And it's the reality is the brain is much smarter than any of us are. So put tape on the skin, let the brain figure it out. It's as simple as
that. And throw a needle in it.
And throw a needle in it. And I like to throw a needle in and then tape over top.
Yes. Cup first, though.
Cup first.
And then hook up the TENS machine.
But yeah, I mean, I have no problem teaching somebody how to tape themselves. And you can get tape about anywhere anymore. You can go to your Walgreens or CVS or Amazon and buy tape. Teaching somebody how to do them themselves, because I can't be there every day, nor do I want to be there all the time, right? Like, let's empower them to take care of themselves.
Do you have to be certified as a healthcare professional to apply kinesio tape?
No. You don't.
Why would you take a course then?
Because it's best practice. Like, here's the thing. You can YouTube how to kinesiology tape a knee, right? And you're going to get, I don't know, 500 different videos pop up.
You can YouTube how to do orthopedic surgery too.
Correct, right?
So I
can go. It doesn't mean you're good, right? Just because I can watch it on YouTube, right? I mean, that's just it, right? Yeah. So best practice. And I also just think there's something to be said for sitting in a room with other like-minded healthcare professionals and
collaborating
shop. Yeah, collaborating and learning and having somebody look over your shoulder and say, hey, that looks good, but you might do this a little bit differently next time. Or here's some different ideas you may not have thought about. I think there's still value to that.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Mitch, we're going to try something that we've actually never tried before. We're going to do the lightning round.
Okay. Oh, the light? So I'm going to ask you.
No, it's still early in the day, right?
Oh, yeah. You can take
my first cup of coffee.
You can take a sip.
A sip and relax. I'm just going to ask some very quick questions that have quick answers that don't need long. Yeah, we'll get you off the soapbox onto another smaller soapbox. All right. Foam rolling. Effective or overvalued?
If done correctly, highly effective.
Good. How about your...
But just laying on a foam roll and blowing back and forth is not correct.
Okay, so a little bit more in depth about the technique on foam roll.
All right, so here's what you have to remember is our fascia is our richest sensory organ. The research says it's somewhere between 9 and 10 times more proprioceptively rich than muscle, right? So all of this idea that I was taught in school of our joint proprioceptors told us where we are in space... No, it's our fascial network that's telling us where we are in space. So we need to understand we have all these receptors in our fascia. We've got Ruffini endings, we've got Paxinian corpuscles, we've got free nerve endings, all these things, and they're telling our brain all this information. We can stimulate each of those differently. So if I want to relax an area, downregulate tone, I want to stimulate my Ruffini endings. How do I do that? Long, deep, slow, sustained pressure. Not pain, but deep, slow, sustained pressure. So I'm going to find a spot. I'm going to chill there for a little bit if I'm looking at post-recovery, right? But if I'm doing it before an activity, now I want to stimulate the nervous system, right? So Paxinian corpuscles, they respond to vibration, fast movements. So now I'm just going to work over an area of the body quickly that I want to get activated and ready to go. So that's like a quick little snippet. But point is, we have to be intentional with how we do things, regardless of what the tool is, regardless of scraping or cupping or foam rolling. They're all just a handle in a nervous system. If we don't understand the nervous system, then it doesn't matter.
Today's episode is sponsored by MetOne Technologies. Looking for innovation in orthopedics? Meet the only U.S.-based, Latin-owned manufacturer originally focused on spinal implants, now leading the way in upper and lower extremity solutions. They've just expanded their portfolio with the newly launched Fortis Distal Radius Plating System, 510K cleared and designed for next-level performance. This isn't just progress, it's representation, precision, and results, all in one.
I love foam rolling, so that's a great answer.
Okay.
Go-to warm-up drill.
I mean, it's got to be dynamic mobility, right? Like some sort of, and I could give you 1,000 different things to do, but we've just got to get people moving actively through a range of motion. It's not necessarily about getting our core temperature up and all that. It's really about just preparing the body for movement and then gradually getting the nervous system turned on with short, quick activities, warming it up like a car in the middle of the winter, right?
Yeah.
Favorite recovery tool under $100.
Oh, that's a great one.
Under $100 recovery?
Approximately.
Post-COVID? Pre-COVID.
How about I go under $20?
Oh, all right.
Floss band.
Oh, what is it?
A floss band. The Voodoo Bands, Voodoo Bands is a brand, right?
Yeah.
But I could argue we can do a lot of range of motion stuff, improving range of motion with floss bands, but we can also...
What is a floss band?
Okay, so latex band, anywhere like 7 to 9 feet long, thick TheraBand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to wrap tissue and then take it through a range of motion, okay? Kelly Starrett made it real popular in the CrossFit community. I think it's a completely undervalued tool. It's like something I can stick in my backpack, literally costs me $15, whatever it is. And I can activate an area. I can improve stability around an area. I can improve range of motion, but I can also use it. I can lay down and wrap it from the foot and gradually work my way up my legs and sort of have a poor man's Normatec sort of thing.
Yeah.
And is it as easy or as effective? No, but it's really good. I've had the opportunity to work with some special operations guys in the military, JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, F4 Bragg. And we literally have said, here's a roll of rock tape and here's a floss band. And here's how you use both of them. When you are out in the field and you're on your own, you can use these two tools for recovery, for injury management, take care of yourself, and give them the tools they can for self-treatment. A really effective tool.
Awesome. Worst training myth you still hear about?
Oh, jeez. Worst training myth I still hear about? I hear about it less than ever, but that we should just be icing everything.
Yeah.
And my orthopedic surgery friends, why are we still putting ice packs out of the OR? That's what I can't wrap.
So are you talking about post-op, if you have a cuff repair and someone comes out in a like a polar care or something like that, or a knee replacement, someone comes out in the knee wrap?
My 14-year-old that has ACL reconstructed in September.
Ain't ready.
Comes
out with
it was an ice pack that I stick in the freezer.
Yeah.
First of all, he's got an inch and a half of padding over top of it.
Yeah, it's not doing anything.
They can't feel anything. But also, we do know that ice slows down the inflammatory process.
Yeah,
true.
Possibly at the cost of tissue healing. So how do you control that?
If you're someone who's played devil's advocate, how do you control it and still get the benefit of it as an athletic trainer? For people that are listening,
I'm not a guy that says don't ice anything. Yeah, I think there's value, but it's mostly pain control, right? So acute injury, somebody sprains an ankle, they get kicked in the shin, throw an ice pack on for 10 minutes, downregulate that pain away.
Right.
But I don't want to slow down that healing process. Right now I'm all about red light. I'll throw a red light wrap on that bad boy. Now I'm going to get pain relief. Plus I'm increasing the inflammatory process. That's what I'd like to see our guys coming out of the OR with. And what's funny is I actually asked my orthopedic surgeon who did the surgery, I'm like, why are we still doing that? And he goes, we still do that? I didn't realize that.
He probably has no idea.
He goes, I close and I walk out the door and I don't know what happens.
He's gone way before they're closing.
Polytech guy in the next room's giving it to you.
I mean, let's be honest, right? Like somebody's got a contract to the hospital or every surgery.
Everybody gets one going out the door.
Or unit when they're out the door. And I think that's unfortunate because A, it's a cost to the medical world, right? That probably doesn't need to happen at a minimum, but we can make the argument that it could potentially slow healing.
Yeah.
Mitch, great. I came out of training with polar cares on every shoulder.
Sure.
And my first week in practice, I asked the surgery center, we're closing the shoulder and putting on the bandages. I said, oh, okay, where's the, ice pack or game ready polar care, whatever. I said, oh, we don't have those. So I'd never look back. So none of my patients come out of the OR with anything on their shoulder. And
I love that.
Now speaking to you, it's good to hear from a professional perspective and a personal perspective. I guess we don't need it.
We don't. I think there's other ways.
Manual techniques.
Here's what I will say, though, is until we talked about how it's so important we have patient buy-in, what I will say is the patients expect to have that.
Yeah.
Right, wrong, or indifferent. So I could make an argument, even though I don't like it, I don't think it matches the science. I could make an argument that there may still be value for some patients that they believe that is care for them. And so they're buying into it.
Yeah.
But that's about all I got.
But it's educating them on why.
Correct.
And what we can do to improve that.
Correct. So we said, you know what? 20 years ago, it was best care. Now it's not.
Now it's not.
But until we change some of the approach with the hospitals, I don't know how we fix that.
Last question. What makes a great sports medicine team?
Communication. That's just what it comes down to. Communication and willingness to continue to evolve and get better. And no egos, right? We're all in this together. We all have a specific role. We all bring a unique perspective to the human body, to the table. Let's appreciate that. Let's learn from each other and realize that we all have value. And let's work together. That's the big piece, right? Regardless of whether or a strength coach, a chiropractor, a PT, an OT, registered dietitian, orthopedic surgeon, we're all in this together and we all play a role. Let's communicate and let's lean on each other when we don't have the answers, because none of us have all the answers. And when we do that, that's where we get best outcomes.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mitch. Your time, your passion. This was great.
I love it.
Really appreciate your time.
He wants to get rock tape.
Yeah. And dry needle.
And dry needle.
I don't have any tape with me. Otherwise, I would too.
Anyway, I really appreciate it. That was awesome.
Thanks, guys. It's awesome.
Thanks for
for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.